Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star and then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Kate, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect workshop, Progress in the Treatment of Myelodysplastic Syndromes, or MDS. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And because of that collaboration and all of your interest in this program, we have over 550 participants on this program. And you come from all over the United States, from many different parts of the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, from Malaysia, Venezuela, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world. It's a bit of a global call. Today's program has been made possible by an educational grant from Celgene, and I want to thank them for their support of the program today. Now, I'd like to turn your attention to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about today's program and about the collaborating organizations. And there also is an evaluation form. I'm going to ask you all to complete that evaluation form at the end of today's program. When you think about it, you are our best consultants in terms of the topics and programs that we should offer going forward. We are planning many programs for the next year, and your recommendations are very important to us. So please tell us what you'd like us to offer, what you like about the programs, and what's helpful to you, and we will be sure to do that. Indeed, today's program is one that many of you have asked us to do, and so we're offering this program today. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Gail Robos, and Dr. Robos is Director, Leukemia Program. She's also Associate Professor of Medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital. And Dr. Robos is going to address an overview of myelodysplastic syndromes, or MDS, current therapies, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Robos.
Thank you very much for the introduction and for the invitation to participate in today's very global-sounding call. And my charge is to get everybody up to speed on what are we actually talking about today. What is myelodysplastic syndrome? Most patients, when they hear this diagnosis, have no idea what their doctor is talking about and cannot spell or pronounce the diagnosis, so I think it's very important to break down the terms and to understand what we're really dealing with. Myelo means bone marrow, and the bone marrow is the part of the body that is the factory for making blood cells. The bone marrow makes white blood cells that fight infection, red blood cells that carry around oxygen and help to give you energy, and platelets, which are the little tiny cells that help you make a clot if you get a cut or are bleeding. And the bone marrow is a super important organ in the body, and you need your bone marrow to work correctly and to produce normal numbers, normal amounts of blood and blood-forming elements. Now, the second part of the term, dysplastic, actually means that the cells look funny under the microscope. And what happens in myelodysplastic syndrome is for a variety of reasons, the blood forming becomes abnormal in a patient. And most typically, patients with MDS have too few of either white blood cells, red blood cells, or platelets, or all three. But occasionally there are patients who also have too many white blood cells as part of MDS. And the second part of the term, syndrome, actually is very important because it really speaks to the fact that there are many different clinical presentations of how this disease can be for an individual patient. Patients are individuals, and different patients with MDS have very different problems, symptoms, and side effects related to their underlying bone marrow disorder. So in myelodysplastic syndrome, what usually happens is that patients either go to their doctor's office with a routine visit and are found to have an abnormal blood test, or they actually go in with a symptom, let's say shortness of breath or fatigue or bruising, some kind of a symptom that would prompt a blood count to be drawn or a CBC to be drawn. Then the internal medicine doctor or whatever doctor has been visited may say, well, there is an abnormality here. You'd better go to a hematologist, oncologist and check this out. And the patient will often then go for a consultation in which the blood test may be repeated and a bone marrow aspiration and biopsy may be recommended. This is not everybody's favorite procedure. They can be done actually reasonably painlessly, but it's not everybody's most favorite time at the doctor's office. But once the bone marrow aspiration and biopsy are completed, that is where the gold standard is for making the diagnosis of MDS. And there are many parts of the pathology that are very important for making this diagnosis, and that includes looking under the microscope, getting chromosome tests called cytogenetics, getting newer and even fancier tests called molecular genetics, and in general, putting together all of the elements that are required for discussion of this disease. Most of the time, patients are loosely grouped into what's termed lower risk versus higher risk diseases. It doesn't mean that somebody with low risk MDS has nothing to worry about, but what it does mean is it gives a sense of the speed at which problems are likely to develop. I have to say that we're not very good at predicting this in all patients, and there certainly are patients who are told that they fit into a lower risk category who have plenty of problems from the disease. But basically what we're talking about in lower risk patients are medications and treatments that are designed to improve blood counts. And what we're talking about for higher risk patients is more intensive treatment that is hopefully going to change the course of the disease quite quickly, because those patients are at risk for getting into bigger trouble, including acute leukemia, in a faster time course typically than those with low risk disease. Now, one of the questions that patients ask most often is that, well, how did I get this? What happened to me that I got this disease? For the majority of patients, we don't know. We know that the incidence goes up with age, but we don't actually know why patients get it. We do know that for some, treatment with chemotherapy and or radiation therapy for another disorder is a risk factor for the development of MDS and can be pointed to in some patients as the likely reason why they got it. And there are associations with certain environmental exposures, but these are very, very difficult to prove. Once the diagnosis has been made, the critical part is the establishment of the correct treatment. There are three commercially available medications to treat MDS: lenalidomide, which is marketed as Revlimid, azacitidine, which is marketed as Vidaza, and decitabine, which is marketed as Dacogen. And these three drugs can be given to improve blood tests, and also can be given in more intensive ways to try, if possible, to put the disease in remission. The only curative therapy for myelodysplastic syndrome is stem cell transplantation, which is a procedure that is available for many patients with the disease, including older patients, and well into their 70s. So the primary question and discussion with your healthcare team is, what is my problem likely to be with this disease? Is it just that I need my blood test to get a little higher? Is it that I'm at risk for turning over to leukemia? You have to make sure that when you communicate with your team, you understand what is the current risk from the disease and what are the treatment options that you may have, both in the commercially available and also in investigational realm, to try to make the clinical problem that you're having better, whether that be giving you a higher white blood cell count so that you're not as much risk for infection, improving red cell counts, improving platelets, or on the higher risk side, trying to get the disease into remission and even possibly considering stem cell transplantation. I think that the next speaker is going to go on to address some of the new treatment approaches for patients with MDS.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Robos, for just a wonderfully informative, excellent, really, overview of MDS and its current therapies and how it's treated. And our next speaker is Dr. Raul Tibbis. Dr. Tibbis is a senior associate consultant and director, acute and chronic leukemia program, Division of Hematology and Medical Oncology, assistant professor, Mayo College of Medicine, Mayo Clinic, Mayo Clinic Cancer Center. And Dr. Tibbis is going to address new treatment approaches, the important role of clinical trials, and how clinical trials contribute to your treatment options. Dr. Tibbis?
Yeah, hello everybody. My name is Raul Tibbis. I'm working at the Mayo Clinic, and thank you very much for inviting me and for the audience, for everybody participating and dialing in today, and for Dr. Robert Scale giving an excellent introduction. So therapies are good for, or I would say therapies have improved for MDS in the last couple of years. As Dr. Robert was mentioning, we have several medications that were approved, Revlimid, Vidaza, or decitabine, Dacogen. So those are very good treatment options for most patients. And they have made a difference in the different MDS groups. And we group MDS by the different risk categories, as was mentioned earlier. So I think the new treatment approaches and how we can think about it depends on what risk group or at what stage the MDS is, meaning how advanced. Is it a low-risk disease where it's mainly reducing symptoms or just reducing the need for red blood cell transfusions or improving the platelets to reduce the risk of bleeding? I think our therapies need to be safe and address those specific problems. So how can we have a new medication that improves the anemia, meaning makes the hemoglobin go up? Or are there medications that specifically improve the platelet count, depending from which of the symptoms a patient with MDS is suffering? For the high-risk MDS patients, those patients where the blood counts are much lower and they're much more of, or many more of those early immature, we call them blasts or leukemia cells, are found in the bone marrow, the risk of going into an acute leukemia is much higher. So for those patients, when we think about therapies in general and new therapies, is how can we delay or prevent even the risk of going on that the MDS transforms or goes into an AML, while at the same time also easing the symptoms and making the patients feel better. I should mention or emphasize that bone marrow transplantation is a curative attempt. So if a patient has a high-risk MDS, I think a patient should be evaluated in a transplant center that is experienced with transplanting patients with MDS to evaluate and be, you know, to look into that option. Chemotherapy regimen, so more intensive cytotoxic chemotherapy regimen, they are still have a role in MDS, but with the development of new therapies, I think they're becoming less and less important, unless it's a true or clear leukemia or very high-risk MDS. So what's the role of clinical trials now and the important role of clinical trials? In a way, what everybody is trying to do or what we as physicians want for our patient and the patient obviously wants as well is to find a better way to treat MDS. I think that's the big role. So I mentioned our therapies are good. They have improved, and several therapies were approved by the FDA, but also in Europe and across the world for treatment of MDS, and Dr. Robos was mentioning some of those. Depending on what group or what stage the MDS is, they may be effective maybe in 30, 40, 50, sometimes up to 60% of the cases. Lenalidomide may be up to 60 or 70%. So overall, if you think about it, that still leaves in the range of 30 to 60% of the patients with a suboptimal response to the first-line treatment. A patient comes to the doctor's office, a treatment is discussed, and the doctor can tell him we have approximately a 50% chance of achieving a very good or excellent response. This means we still have 50% room of improving therapy for our patients with MDS. And I think here where clinical trials have an important role. So I think about clinical trials, especially for patients that are being treated for the first time, so first-line treatment, I always want to incorporate one of the approved drugs. So Vidaza or decitabine for the most part for most patients, for the more advanced patients, I should say. So trial is then essentially taking 5-azacitidine and based on the best available science, add another medication, where researchers and scientists from across the world have found some potential new therapy that may make a difference. And then a physician can talk to the patient and can suggest, hey, I can give you the 5-azacitidine or the decitabine, which are good options, or I can give you the same drug with another drug. And that's one way to think about clinical trials. So use our commonly used drugs, make them better, and add a new drug based on the best available science. Another role for clinical trials is if a patient has received one of those approved medications for MDS, he's not a transplant candidate or does not want to have transplant, chemotherapy is not an option, or the patient does not want to have chemotherapy, but he still wants to be treated for the MDS, apart from getting transfusions and, you know, addressing all the symptom and all the best supportive care, essentially. I think there's a second role for trials. So essentially, in patients that have not responded to the upfront therapy, offering new trials, offering new medications, and offering patients that access to those new medications. I should mention that most of the clinical trials, and there are some large studies conducted, are very safe. And I think as a general rule in oncology and in cancer and also for MDS, we usually do not use placebo. So placebo could be a sugar pill or a pill that does not have the active drug in it. Yes, there are some exceptions, but I think for the most part, especially the early clinical trials, most patients do get actually the drug or what's thought to be an active drug. And those clinical trials are safe. Patients are very closely watched. They're very closely monitored and followed up, you know, in the clinic and by clinical study nurses, and they see the physician often. So I think it is a good option for patients. How do clinical trials contribute? Well, first of all, I think everybody, doctors, we want to help our patient. That's our first goal. If a patient comes in, we want to find the best drug, what we think is the best drug for our patients to improve the disease of the patient, to make him suffer less, to reduce the symptoms and the burden of his disease. Then give patients access to the newest and latest medications developed based on the best science available we have right now. And at the same time, we also want to learn about the MDS. Ideally, it should benefit the patient we're treating at the time. We cannot always tell the patient that this is will benefit you directly, but we will learn about and more about MDS and how to treat MDS in a better way. And it may actually benefit and help you, the individual patient, but it will also help learn generally how to treat MDS. I think a positive aspect is also what we're seeing with, let's call it, genomics revolution. So everybody here probably reads and hears about all the typing of the genome and detecting of all the genes and mutation analysis. And I think, you know, many of the big cancer centers and other hospitals are now starting to offer to individually, molecularly profile a patient. And hopefully in the next couple of years, we will see a rapid development that a patient comes in, we test his entire genome, all his genes, and see if there's any abnormality in any of those genes, and maybe we find now an appropriate drug. And then a couple of weeks later, we could talk to the patient and said, we found this in your genome, and maybe now we have a better drug available. Or at least we can stratify patients, meaning there are certain genetic abnormalities, and if we can measure them, detect them, I think in the future we'll have more and more drugs available that can match that genetic abnormality of a specific patient. It's still a little bit away, but I think we're making progress. And investigating those treatment options, they mostly occur under the umbrella or within a clinical trial. So I think it's important for a patient, and I will finish, to consider it, talk to your doctor about it. Is there anything available for me that, you know, may benefit me as well as learn more about the MDS? Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Tibbetts. That was a wonderful presentation and very informative about the role of clinical trials and new treatment approaches, and really to consider clinical trials as a treatment option. Thank you. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Dr. Elias Jabbour. Dr. Jabbour is Associate Professor, Leukemia Department at the University of Texas, MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Jabbour is going to address supportive care to manage anemia, fatigue, and control infections, symptom management, and quality of life concerns, including nutritional concerns and tips. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Jabbour.
Thank you, Karen. Thank you very much for the invitation. Glad to be here today. After the talks of my wonderful colleagues, my role is to go over mainly supportive care and the management of MDS. Alluded to, MDS, it's not one disease. It's a spectrum of diseases that can go from really low risk to a stage where patients can have more aggressive disease. Fortunately enough, the majority of our patients who will come to see us in a low-risk stage means these patients, they will have the main problem, anemia. Around 70% of this patient population will be in this category of low risk, and the main problem is anemia. They can be like running blood tests for whatever reason, and we will get a call from the referral physician that, well, the count is low, what shall I do? Or sometimes patient can go to the emergency center because of chest pain, and then they discover they have anemia, so they give them 2 units of blood or some vitamins and then send them home, and then patients will come back again for more and more blood. So the main symptom is related to the anemia and having low hemoglobin. And the cornerstone of therapy at the beginning is mainly to give blood. And patients will start getting blood 2 units at the beginning, maybe every year, every 6 months, and then the need will start increasing. So what we can do for that? Besides blood transfusions, growth factors, will that be helpful? And I know you're facing problems sometimes with the insurance, or who will cover for growth factors, who won't cover for growth factors. Studies have been done, and they showed mainly then when you give growth factors, you can get some response in around 40% where your hemoglobin will increase to a stage where you will not need any more blood. And on average, a treatment can induce a response for a median of 2 years. And on average, patients who do benefit from this strategy are patients with low erythropoietal level. So your doctors will check for the erythropoietal level at the start, and patient with low need for blood. Means if you're getting 2 units of blood or less per month, you do way better than if you're getting 2 units of blood every week. So talk to your doctor. There's a major role for growth factors in a situation where your level of erythropoietin is low, and mainly you're getting a blood on average less than 2 units per month, and that is very helpful. Unfortunately, sometimes we do see patients who are getting like 2 units of blood every day, and growth factors and insurance are not covering these bills, and that here where we need to look for clinical trials, and there's several of them addressing how we can improve the function of the stem cell or the hematopoietic stem cell in order to improve the count without causing any damage or progression. Because what you're concerned about it here, I don't want to give any agent, growth factor that can push the blood to go up, and that may not be the aim of any treatment. So blood transfusions is offered. Growth factors are helpful as well on average on a subset of patients with low need and low erythropoietin level. So we're giving blood. That means when I give iron, because as you know, there is no way we can eliminate this iron from the body. And there's a big debate in the U.S. and across the world whether iron chelation can help patients or not. Originally, there were studies that shown that iron overload is bad for the patient. They live on average shorter than those who don't have iron overload. However, if we collate this patient, can we improve the outcome? The answer is in a prospective fashion, unanswered, unknown. Studies are ongoing. Nevertheless, the recommendations today is when you have somebody with a low-risk disease, merely getting blood more than 20 units per year and having a ferritin level above 1,000, the consensus is to consider chelation in these patients, although randomized studies assessing in a prospective fashion the efficacy of such a strategy is ongoing. When you have iron overload, what we sometimes underestimate, you have patients coming with fatigue, their diabetes is dysregulated, they have low appetite, and that may be due to the hormonal dysfunction, due to the deposit of iron in an organism among the endocrine glands, such as the thyroid gland, the pancreas, and others. So this is really need to be discussed with your doctor, and don't like blame it on, oh, okay, you have disease or you have diabetes, let it go on. No, talk to them, and maybe some tuning may help in that setting. Recently, there was some interest as well when you have iron overload to give chelation, and the idea is not only to remove the iron from the body, the excess of iron, but eventually, in a simple terms, when you clean a stem cell environment, you may leave a room for the cells to grow again, and replacing the low count that is really observed in this disease. There is anecdotal experience where really we can improve the count by giving the iron chelation, and that is a strategy that is pursued right now in different places, and hopefully will lead on its own or in combination with a therapy available to better outcome. And one of the fatigue may be sometimes related to the iron overload, so we have to think about it while we treat somebody with an MDS. I want to talk about low platelets. Unfortunately, today we don't have a treatment for low platelets. The only way is to give platelet transfusions, and with time they become less helpful. But studies are ongoing to assess the role of thrombomimetic or growth factors for the platelets in order to improve the platelet count. Infections, despite sometimes having a normal count, and we look at the white count, it is there. We look at the neutrophils. These cells are dysfunctional in the vast majority of the cases. So you need to have high index of suspicion when you have a minor infection, when you have swelling or redness of your skin. Please call your doctor and report this incident, because antibiotic may be helpful. I'm not saying stay on antibiotic prophylactically, but I'm saying you have to be very suspicious when you have a minor thing to call your doctor and get things under control. Symptoms are mainly driven by the count, whether you have an infection, a fever, a bleeding from the low platelets, and anemia causing fatigue, chest pain sometimes. So these are mainly disease-driven. And the tools I mentioned, from the growth factors, from the blood need, from the antibiotic and platelets, can help overcoming these issues. Finally, regarding quality of life, as you know, when you have low-risk MDS, patient can have a normal lifespan, and we need to do everything to address every issue that can have the patient having the best outcome, whether at home, enjoying their families, or whatever they are doing. So with the transfusion, with the close monitoring, we may able to respond to the need of the patient in a real time, and that again pushed me, and I know that she will go over to the good communication with the healthcare providers, including every aspect you have to discuss, please, we are here for that. Regarding neutral concern and tips, it's becoming more and more an issue of the day, what to eat, what to do. I always ask my patient to keep a healthy life, regardless of what's going on. Means a healthy diet can help anybody, whether you have an MDS or you don't. Exercises are always helpful. Having a weight acceptable in a normal range is always acceptable. So I don't go into like magical prescriptions, but just at least having a normal, a good diet, a healthy diet, and a healthy life, it will always help. It will never hurt. No, there are certain circumstances where you have infection is a question here, like, for example, eating creams after like a cake being out of the fridge for 5 days, that is not only for MDS but for everybody. Having eating raw fish sometimes may not be very helpful. Very careful with the infections. So these are tips that can be offered to any human being, regardless whether they have MDS or not. So a lot of success, a lot of things are happening in this disease today. Dr. Robert and Tibet mentioned it. So stay tuned. Talk to your doctor, and we are here anytime you need us. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Shabora, and thank you for actually just a wonderful presentation. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And in terms of just managing symptoms and also just in terms of just being that your physician's, a very important point that Dr. Shabora made is that your physician is there for you, and to really ask those questions of your physician when you have them, to not have to wait. Many people wait between appointments a month or something like that. We don't want you to have to wait between appointments. What he's really saying to you is that they're available and do ask them questions that you may have. So thank you, and thanks for all those very important tips and information you gave to everybody. And our next speaker is Ms. Maria Chi, and Ms. Chi is an oncology social worker, and she's a clinical supervisor at Cancer Care, and she will be addressing the free psychosocial support services offered by Cancer Care, as well as the important role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Ms. Chi.
Thanks, Carolyn. As a social worker here at Cancer Care, I'd like to briefly talk about the emotional and social impact of cancer and how Cancer Care can help. When you're first diagnosed with myelodysplastic syndrome, or MDS, it can be an overwhelming experience. You're faced with a series of choices and may not know where to turn. Talking to a Cancer Care social worker can help you get the support you need. Cancer Care is a staff of licensed master's level oncology social workers, and all of our services are completely free of charge. We're experienced in helping people to manage the emotional, physical, and financial challenges that come with a cancer diagnosis. One of the most important things to acknowledge about the emotional impact of cancer is that it can be felt as a loss. It can be a loss that manifests itself in many ways for both patients and caregivers. That's why it's so important to have an outlet to acknowledge how you're feeling and have someone you can talk to who will be supportive and understanding. This can mean talking one-on-one with a Cancer Care social worker or joining one of our support groups. Cancer Care offers face-to-face groups in our local offices in the New York area, as well as telephone and online groups. These groups offer an opportunity to talk with other people impacted by cancer, such as MDS, along with the help of a Cancer Care social worker to facilitate the group. Participating in a support group can be helpful simply by allowing you to talk with others who are in a similar situation and who truly understand in a way that no one else can. Group members offer encouragement and a real sense of community that can provide you with additional support and guidance. If you're interested in participating in a group, please call our Hope Line at 800-813-4673. Finally, MDS can have a significant impact on your finances, and for many of the people I talk to every day, this can be an overwhelming aspect. Cancer Care provides limited financial assistance to help with transportation, home care, child care, or pain medication. We can also connect you with other organizations for additional assistance to help you with the costs of cancer. So please contact us at 1-800-813-4673 or visit our website at cancercare.org for more information about our oncology social work support. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Maria, for an excellent presentation and really a wonderful review of the services that people can access for free from Cancer Care. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Kate to bring all of our speakers on board and to explain to all of you how to queue up for questions, both on the telephone or online. And Kate, if you would explain to everybody, and we'll take as many of your questions as possible. If we do not get to your question, please call us at 1-800-813-4673, and I'll repeat that number again at the end of the call. But let's see how many we can take now. Kate?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. And I'm showing we have a question from the line of Shirley G. Your line is open.
Yes, I wanted to know, doctors, I don't know which one to ask, but is there a connection between MGUS, monoclonal gammopathy, or clonal T-cell proliferation, and myelodysplasia?
Oh, thank you. That's an excellent question. I'm going to ask Dr. Robos if she would address that question. Thank you. In a general way, and then we'll help you go back to your healthcare team with that information. Dr. Robos?
Sure. So MGUS, or monoclonal gammopathy of uncertain significance, is a condition which can sometimes be identified concomitantly or at the same time as MDS. That's not infrequent. And there can actually be clonal plasma cell disorders that have chemotherapy treatment, which then subsequently could result in myelodysplastic syndrome. But the two diseases are separate, and the relationship between them, again, is that they might be identified simultaneously, and that MDS could be secondary to chemotherapy type of treatment, usually not for MGUS, but for example, multiple myeloma. MGUS is typically treated in a manner that is just observation and not requiring therapy. Now, the second question was about clonal lymphocyte disorders, and that's a little bit different. So things like LGL leukemia, for example, can also be associated with low blood counts and are part of the differential diagnosis of myelodysplastic syndrome in such a way that your doctor may, in initially working up a diagnosis of low blood count, maybe thinking about the possibility, for example, of LGL, but these should be able to be discriminated and distinguished pathologically because they do have different results when the appropriate testing is sent to the pathology lab. Again, in principle, you could be treated for an LGL disorder, for example, with chemotherapy and subsequently develop MDS, but that would be the way that they're related. They are not part of the, presumably not part of the same clonal process as one would be in the myeloid lineage and the other is in the lymphoid lineage. I don't know if my colleagues have anything in addition that they would like to say about that.
Thank you, Dr. Robles. And Dr. Tibbis and Dr. Jabbour, do you wish to add to that?
No, I think Dr. Robles described it very well.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you. Excellent question. I have a question from one of our online participants. At what point should a patient who is diagnosed as MDS unclassifiable participate in therapy or a clinical trial? Dr. Tibbis, could you address that question?
Oh, that's a broad question, but a good question. I think it's first, we need to establish if a patient needs therapy. And, that's sometimes straightforward, and that's sometimes difficult. So there are some situations where it's rather easy, where, we commonly observe the patients. So if it's a little bit of anemia, it's the first occurrence of anemia, maybe the platelets are still normal or just a touch lower, bone marrow biopsy is done, and MDS is, found, meaning there's some abnormalities in the cells, the way the cells look under the microscope, that's how we diagnose the MDS. As well as, looking at the cytogenetics or the chromosome analysis of those MDS cells. So let's say we have established the diagnosis of an MDS or an MDS unclassified. If it's just a little bit of anemia, a patient may not need therapy. So very early, low risk. And there are some risk scores. Some are called the IPSS, and there's an IPSSR. So those are giving physicians an idea how quickly a patient's MDS may get worse, and that may help us to determine how quickly a patient may need therapy or if it's the right time to initiate therapy. On the other hand, all those, molecular markers, all those risk stratification tools we find, as I always tell my patients, doesn't substitute or doesn't make up for, getting to know the patient, getting to know his blood counts, getting to know him or her, the preferences of treatment, and just following the patient and observing the patient and then developing a treatment plan, which brings it back to a good communication. So for the very low-risk MDS, sometimes it's appropriate to observe and not do any intervention and just monitor the blood counts. And once the blood counts get worse, maybe repeat a bone marrow biopsy. Some patients with more advanced MDS come in and, have a high number of blasts, so-called leukemic cells, and therapy is indicated. And then we could look into and say, okay, is there a clinical trial available for the patient? Often we would choose one of the standard drugs or standard drug plus a novel drug. If we don't have any of those trials open or the patient is not living close to a center that has a clinical trial, he can go to another experienced physician and be treated with a regular decitabine or 5-azacitidine. So I would always look into a clinical trial. I would not, how I call it, compromise in any of the good drugs out there already, but we can incorporate them into new therapies. And the more advanced the MDS, the more, you know, urgent or the sooner therapy should be initiated. In any case, I think I mentioned that if a patient is younger, if a patient is fit enough, and if there's an advanced MDS, a stem cell transplantation or bone marrow transplantation is the only curative option we know for patients. So those patients should at least think about it and talk to their doctor about it openly and see, is that, you know, may that be something for myself.
Excellent. Thank you.
You know, I just want to add one thing to what Dr. Tibas mentioned for the patients.
Yes.
MDS, it's a really, it's a spectrum of diseases, and sometimes minor subtleties can make huge change. So I always advise our patients with MDS to go seek a second opinion, at least to get the pathology reviewed, to get really an accurate diagnosis and staging. And then they can follow with the local doctors, but at least get the slides or the pathology to be reviewed by academic centers with people with experience. And then there will be like a good communication between the academic centers and the local doctors for the best of their patients. So please always get like at least a pathology reviewed, an assessment to get an accurate diagnosis and a good staging.
That's an excellent point, Dr. Jabbour. Is there a particular type of pathologist that should be reviewing their materials?
You know, we and others, we've shown that around usually 15% of the cases, we can have discrepancies between what is done outside and what is reviewed in academic centers where they see a lot of these patients. And even among academic centers, sometimes there are a lot of debates. I mean, among experts, what is the real diagnosis? What is the real staging? I mean, in a big proportion, it's very straightforward, but sometimes it can be tricky. So really it's important to seek opinion or get the disease assessed by experts, and then the treatment can be done at home thereafter, and a follow-up can be done between home and academic centers.
Excellent, thank you. Now we have a question, another question from one of our online participants. My husband has been told that he should expect infections and that only severe infections will require doctor attention and treatment. Minor infections must simply be lived with. What constitutes a minor infection? So I'm going to ask Dr. Jabbour if you could address this whole area of infections. I know you've addressed it in part already, but in terms of for this particular caller and others who may have been given similar information like that, in terms of guidelines that you would give them about infections, and so if you would...
You know, it's hard to define on the phone whether minor infection and severe infections. Obviously, severe infections, infection with complication, impact on other organs, that is absolutely an indication to be in the hospital and be aggressively managed. But what I want to say is, despite the fact that patient can have low risk and the count can look okay, these are dysfunctional, and patient can, on average, have a lowered immune system, doesn't function very well, and they put them at risk of infection that they are usually normal, the normal person don't catch, and even we can see fungal infections being invasive, affecting the lungs, the sinus, and others. So the whole idea is any unusual sign, we should have a low index of suspicion for an infection and be aggressive even with a minor infection that seems to be like skin infection, minor skin infection that on average you can take topical antibiotic and we're fine or we ignore, that should prompt the patient to seek care, to be assessed by the doctor and address the question with antibiotic, oral antibiotic or intravenous antibiotic, depends on the situation. Like sometimes we have cough and we give antibiotic and we go home. In that setting, maybe we need to do a CAT scan and get infectious disease to see the patient and eventually start more than one antibiotic. So bottom line, always infection, regardless of the severity, should be taken seriously, should prompt a care, and should be addressed in an aggressive way to avoid further complications.
Carolyn, it's
yes.
Dr. Robos. May I add one comment also, just in case this is also helpful to patients, that it is a good thing to get to know your numbers and to get to know what they mean. And in the case of infections, the neutrophil number or the absolute neutrophil count or the ANC is something that your doctor can easily share with you. And in general, if the neutrophil count is under 1,000, and most especially if it's under 500, this can be very, very serious, even in the setting of what seems to be a minor infection. So I think Dr. Jabbour's point is perfect, that something that seems minor, but when it is in the setting of an especially low neutrophil count, can really turn into a problem quickly, and most especially if associated with a fever or any chills in the patients who have fewer than 1,000 neutrophils, that takes a minor situation and turns it into a major one. If the neutrophil count is over 1,000, Dr. Jabbour's point is well taken, that these can be poorly functioning white blood cells, so just the number isn't completely protective, but it's probably less likely that a minor type of skin or even respiratory infection would be quite as rapidly progressive and severe as in the situation I'm describing when the neutrophils are low. So please take the opportunity with your doctor on your printouts of your lab that you might even get on the same day in the office to know where your neutrophils are, and most especially if they are under 1,000 and then even worse under 500, to be especially careful under those circumstances.
Yeah. Maybe one comment is I always describe it to my patients, it's, you know, if the neutrophils or the white blood cell counts are very low, you know, patients are very open to infections, almost like a baby, because there are not enough cells to fight that. And things can happen very quickly. And sometimes if there are very few or no neutrophils left, within a couple of hours, the patient can become very sick. So I tell my patients, if you're sick on a Friday, never wait till Monday. Don't call your nurse on a regular line. Just call, you know, the doctor who's covering, or come to the emergency room. And sometimes there is no fever. Patients can also feel bad if they don't have fever, because we all need white cells and neutrophils to fight the infection. Sometimes, even without a fever, there can be an infection, and it can be overwhelming for the body within a couple of hours. So what Dr. Robos was saying, know your neutrophils, know your numbers, and be rather on the side of caution, as Dr. Jabbour was saying, and come in or call your doctor one too many times. And your doctors don't mind. We don't mind. You know, I'd rather hear from you on Sunday morning at 3 o'clock and know that you're okay than, you know, seeing you Monday that you're not okay.
That's really, I hope everybody heard that. That's really important, that to call your doctor when you have when something's bothering you, because most likely it needs attention, clearly, and they'd rather deal with you when it's bothering you than to have it become more of a problem. And there is a follow-up question from Martha online. Should a person with a neutrophil count of 500 consider taking Vidaza? Dr. Tibbis, do you want to address that?
With a neutrophil count of 500, take Vidaza. Well, it would depend if there's a high number of blasts in the bone marrow, as well as if the other blood lineages, meaning the platelets or the red cells, are affected, as well as the age of the patient, and for how long the patient has had the MDS. So if the blood counts or the ANC has fallen quickly, and let's say there was a diagnosis 3 months ago, and now 3 months later the ANC went from normal to 500, and there were no blasts, and all of a sudden there are more and more blasts in the bone marrow, that's a sign that therapy should be, you know, started. If the patient is 80 years old and has MDS for the last 5 years and has a low-risk MDS, and now his ANC is slowly coming down, meaning the ANC is falling, you know, one may still wait a little bit. So just treating the numbers or the ANC, I think we usually don't do that. You know, we take it in the overall picture of the treatment plan of the patient. Does he need therapy? What's our long-term goals of the therapy? Meaning, are we, and how quickly is the MDS, you know, progressing, or how stable is the MDS? So that's probably what I would say. My colleagues, anything else?
You know what, I agree with Dr. Tevis, what he mentioned. Again, we have to get a whole staging, a whole assessment, whether the low count is merely isolated low count, or patient had a blast in the bone marrow, had a very sick bone marrow not producing. We check the chromosomes as well, so get an idea of the scoring system, where the disease is placed on the spectrum, and therefore decide on therapy. Now, sometimes we can have only low count, and that brings us as well to the question, do we really have MDS? Maybe there's anaplastic anemia, maybe something else. And then for an accurate diagnosis is important in order to establish the best treatment.
And I would just add, one other, sure, I would just add one other comment. It's counterintuitive for patients who are already starting out with low blood counts to think that they are taking a therapy that's going to potentially make the blood counts even lower. So you need to think about two important things. The first thing is that the blood counts in the case of MDS are low because of the disease. So if you're not doing anything to make the disease get better, the blood counts are not going to get better on their own. That's the first important point, that, again, you must treat the underlying disease. The second issue is that numbers will get worse before they get better. And for patients starting on azacitidine or decitabine, one of the first conversations I have with them is that the numbers are going to get worse before they get better. You're going to require possibly more infusions and more neutropenic precautions and more discussion of low blood counts, which, again, for patients can initially be very upsetting, that, hey, I thought my counts were low. Why are you giving me a medication that's going to make them even lower? You must be patient because it takes time for these drugs to work and to actually change the functioning of the bone marrow to allow those numbers to get better. So it is a completely expected event that numbers get worse before they get better for many patients on these therapies, and it does not necessarily mean at all that you either shouldn't start or that you're on the wrong treatment. In fact, it may mean that you're exactly on the right track.
It's like kind of the war of the clones. If somebody, the bad clones, they need to leave and they need to get rid of or get out of the bone marrow. And then the good clones can grow back, meaning the good normal blood cells can grow back.
This is a wonderful dialogue amongst all of the physicians on the call. It's wonderful for everyone to hear this kind of back and forth dialogue. It's very rare that everyone on the call hears this, so many wonderful opinions and help. Now we have another question, Kate, can you... one of our telephone questions.
Our next question comes from the line of David S. Your line is open.
Thank you for taking my call. I've really enjoyed the discussion today. I was reading an expert article this weekend on a drug called vosaroxin that's used to treat AML, and it made it sound as if it may be in the sooner than later used in experimental purposes to see about, in this line, MDS. And I was wondering if anyone on the panel has had any experience with this drug?
David, thank you for that question. Do any of our speakers want to address this question?
Sure, I can. So I have experience with the drug, and it is being used. It is being used in clinical trials for AML patients, and there is actually an expectation that there will be a clinical trial available for patients with MDS who are no longer responding to conventional, commercially available MDS therapies to be able to enter a clinical trial of vosaroxin.
Oh, excellent. Okay. Well, that's
maybe to add, I mean, this is one new drug that's out there used in AML. Sometimes drugs are used first, in the more aggressive of, acute leukemias, acute myeloid leukemia, AML, and then they're also brought more and more into the earlier stages of MDS. So we may see that. But there's, a whole host of other drugs and medications out there currently being tested or investigated in MDS. So the vosaroxin is just one example, I don't want to, and I can't give all the different numbers and names of the medications. But there's an active field, and there's new medications that try to go after different mechanisms targeting the MDS cells. So Vozoroxin is still more like coming from a chemotherapy backbone, a little modified. But there's other medications that try to be, you know, more and more targeted towards the underlying mechanism in the MDS cells. So fortunately, we have a whole arena and range of medications available.
So please, everyone, stay tuned. There's more to hear, and this is what we know as of today, but like what Dr. Tibbetts and Dr. Robas, Dr. Jabbour is saying, there's much more to come. So we'll be offering more programs in the future with all the new developments as well. And we have one more question, Kate.
Our next question comes from the line of Cheryl R. Your line is open.
Yes. I have MDS, too. My aunts have had it, different cells, and my great aunt has also had it. And the great-aunt's mother died of leukemia at about age 46. Is there a possible genetic factor there?
Well, thank you for that question, Cheryl. And Dr.
Sure, I will be happy to take this one. Because as it happens, I'm working right now with a couple of different patients who have interesting family histories of kind of too many examples of either MDS or AML in family members. And a lot of times the truth is we just can't figure out why something like this happens kind of too many times in the same family. But actually there are certain mutations that are associated with familial MDS, and there's also a group of diseases called familial platelet disorders. So they can actually be identified. And I would say that for patients like you who have multiple family members who seem to be coming up with diagnoses of myeloid malignancies, it's absolutely worthwhile to be seen in an academic center that has the ability to do some sequencing studies and to really get a very detailed history of exactly what the other family members have. Because most of the time, the truth is that the information doesn't let us do anything different right at this moment in terms of treatment or prevention, but it may actually be quite helpful in suggesting a monitoring plan for family members who could possibly be affected, A, and B, the genomics age is upon us, as was already described, and the expectation is that with increasing frequency, not in 100 years, but in a few months to years, we might actually have things to offer that are based specifically on certain identified genetic abnormalities. So I would say get yourself to an academic center to have the discussion of further sequencing and potentially genetic counseling depending on what's identified.
Oh, excellent. Thank you so much. And I want to thank our speakers. You've just been extraordinary. This has been a remarkable call. I want to thank all of you who've also asked such wonderful questions. And remind you, this is a one-hour program and that we recognize when we plan a program like this that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. So I do want to remind you that although the call is soon to end, the services from Cancer Care, those continue, and they are free services. And you can contact us at 1-800-813-4673 if you didn't get to ask your question or think of another question you'd like to have answered, or if you need some of our services, if you wish to talk to one of our social workers or join a support group, or listen to one of our upcoming workshops, or access some of our materials and the fact sheets that we have as well. Most importantly, as we're about to conclude the program, I don't want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping with MDS or in coping with cancer in general. I want you to know that you're part of this community of support, and we're here to help you. And we're simply a telephone call away at 1-800-813-4673, or visit our website at www.cancercare.org. Thank you all, and I want to wish you all a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may disconnect. Have a wonderful day.